Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics, featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by our panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Michael Bauer, Stephanie Hitt, Mike Miller, Chris Varonis, and Phil Cowan. Our program tonight coming to you from home base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago, where our phone lines are open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's Bruce Dumont at museum.tv. And if you'd like to tweet me a comment, it's at Dumo, at D-U-M-O. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web at beyondthebeltway.com. For those listening on radio a little bit later on in the broadcast, we'll be joined by Howard Kurtz, the media critic and the host of Media Buzz on Fox News Channel. But again, like always, we have lots to talk about in our broadcast this evening. And I want to begin with a big story about the President of the United States being invited to meet with the President of North Korea. And he has agreed to do that sometime in May. And Chris Varonis, we thank you. Welcome to our broadcast. You've been a longtime critic of Donald Trump. What is your reaction to the news, the way it was announced, and the quick response that he's going to go and have the meeting?
As a longtime critic of the president, you deserve some credit. You know, there are some who said all of Trump's pressure tactics, the administration's pressure tactics, were careening towards war. Then there were some that were saying, well, this is what the North Koreans, this is what they respond to. This is how to get them to the table. And that's exactly what happened. Now, having said that, I don't think Donald Trump is fully aware of the intense headwinds that lay before him with this, because he's not just about to argue with North Korea, but with history, and I'm sure we'll get into it.
Stephanie Hitt, one of our card-carrying Republicans, you are a pro-Trumper.
Pretty much so, and I think what we're seeing is sort of the magic of Donald Trump, and that is, you know, he can do this sort of posturing on the outside with a hubris, rocket man, calling him all sorts of names, and while he's doing that, at the same time, his administration is sort of quietly working with China, and this was not done without the cooperation with China and South Korea. And I think that what we're seeing is the genius that might be going on strategically on that level as well. So I think that's what we're going to see more of.
Michael Bauer, card-carrying Democrat, your reaction.
Well, supposedly when Barack Obama and Donald Trump met at the White House, Barack Obama told Donald Trump that his number one issue, number one problem would be North Korea. For 25 years, we've tried to deal with North Korea and have not found any successful path. I would much rather have Donald Trump meeting with Kim Jong-un and talking, even though color me skeptical that anything will come out of it, rather than them threatening each other with nuclear weapons.
Mike Miller from DePaul University, an economist, your reaction. Not a big fan of Donald Trump. But
I'm happy he's president as opposed to the alternative. His strong-arm tactics against North Korea and the belief that he will always follow through has led North Korea to the verge of bankruptcy. And I've checked some of my – I have more than a few friends who are Korean-Americans. They are on the verge of bankruptcy. And it is partly because of the deal between the Chinese, the Americans, and the South Koreans, and that other countries simply won't trade with them. And the fact that he's willing to put on the table denuclearization is a major breakthrough.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Chris.
But here we go again.
Right.
Right? I mean, this is a game. This is a game that goes back to Bill Clinton, where basically the North Koreans research, develop, make strides in their nuclear program, and then the West gets bothered by it, and then they say, okay, we'll come to the table. And either that buys them time or that solidifies their gains. And then we come to some kind of agreement, and they cheat on it. And then here we are again.
Yeah, but okay. I wonder what is more important, that this got to the point that will keep the Kims in power. In my mind, keeping the Kims in power is the important thing. And if they will be – if they get the word of the West that we will not attack you, we will not knock you out of power, I see no reason for the North to have nuclear arms, and I would think they can give them up.
I also think that the president, and he would take a lot of bashing because of it, I don't think he's going to sit down with Kim and say, you know what, you've got to democratize this country. You've got to let women in vote. You've got to do all. I mean, I don't think he's going to say that. Now, a lot of his critics would like him to say that and stand up for democracy and say, you know, you run an atrocious regime here. But you know what? I don't think he's going to. I don't think he's going to play that card. Whereas I think the predecessors would have played that card and perhaps did play that card, Michael. And
well,
maybe that's one of the reasons why we have had no success.
You know, we have other parties that are involved in this, like China and South Korea.
Oh, big for China.
And, you know, China has to wonder about if we did democratize or if somehow South Korea and North Korea were to unite, sort of like the unification of Germany or something like that. Then China's going to be really worried. So
well,
I think
but
you know.
But no one's talking democratization; they're talking denuclearization,
But I do believe that there will be some agreement about not trying to unseat Kim Jong, you know, the Kim family, and that's
his principal goal,
right? The principal goal for us is to make sure they don't have nukes.
I have to tell you, I think Mike Miller is absolutely right that these economic sanctions have had a devastating effect on North Korea. And the probably one of the major issues, if not the single major issue, the Kim Jong-un is trying to improve the economic conditions for the people in North Korea. And he can't do that as long as these economic sanctions are in force.
We've been here before. This is a state that had famine. I mean, you've got a whole generation of North Koreans who are deformed because of malnutrition.
Right.
And so we've been here before. Kim, he's got a nuclear bomb, and I don't think he's going to give it up as easily as you say, Michael, one. And then two, he has got the history of his father, his grandfather, about unifying the peninsula under communism. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is a motivation you can't diminish.
And I want to add another dimension to this. One of the things, and maybe it's because I'm a University of Virginia graduate, Donald Trump made it a very early priority in his administration to free Otto Warmbier, who was the young UVA student that was held and then returned in a coma.
Yes.
And, in fact, it was so important to him, and I do believe that this president really, truly cares about that issue. He cares about this family. He still, to this day, still talks about Otto Warmbier.
Yes.
And their family was at the State of the Union this year.
Yes.
They were up there, prominent. And
he has made this almost a
personal venture as well, I think.
But do you think that he would use that in any drawing of a line in the sand?
No,
North Korea said, you know what, we're going to give up our nukes, and we want support from all the allies to prop our nation up, including the United States. Don't you think most of the allies would do that, including China, if they said they're not going to build nukes? I think that's what he wants. And by the way, we want to stay in power. That's part of the deal.
I think it's a testament also to his sincerity of seeing this issue through.
I don't doubt that he has a sincerity to see the deal through, because if it were to happen, many of the people who literally despise him, they still wouldn't like him, but they would have a harder case to make if he goes out and frankly makes some degree of peace with North Korea. Right. I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly from Chicago, 1-800-723-8289.
This March, Goodman Theatre artistic director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheater.org.
We are back. And a question to you, Mike Miller. How much of this movement on the part of the United States to meet with Kim Jong-un, how much of it do you think is out of maybe some degree of fear because of relations between South Korea and North Korea, maybe thawing a bit in the wake of the Olympics, and that literally South Korea is sort of driving us to this decision?
Yeah.
You know, very interesting you say that. This past Friday, I was talking to my Korean American friends at the university, and that's exactly what they argued, that over the next three Olympics, which are going to be in Japan after this one and in Beijing, which would be over a six-year period, that the North and South could easily have a common flag and common teams, which would create this agreement that we don't need the United States in South Korea anymore.
Chris, and what do you think of that idea?
I think there's a lot to it. South Korean president
is a dove. Yeah, he's a communist.
You know, he ran on dialing down the tensions.
Yep.
He wants his interests don't coincide with the United States' interests, which is a free and secure South Korea. So it's a delicate sort of triangulation that's happening here. Mm-hmm. You know, you've got the three corners. You've got South Koreans, the Americans, and the North Koreans. I think the North Koreans recognize that. That's an opening. Aside from the fact that they ran out of money, the slush fund.
They're out of money.
Right. The slush fund that Kim relies on is empty. Okay? And so, again, I say, here we go again.
Yeah.
Well, let's go to the table, buy time, solidify our gains, and see if we could probably lose some of the United States
allies. Because so many people in this country and in the world worry about an expansion of their nuclear program.
Yep.
Right.
Fearful that there is no military, there is no winning military strategy, no matter who you're talking to, the most hawk-like person you know would acknowledge that it could be a devastating effect. The big losers in that would be South Korea. They would be the French and Japan. So I'm also wondering if the stakes are very high. And again, if we're saying to North Korea, we want you to denuclearize, get rid of all your nukes, could they say to us, okay, we want you out of the DMZ.
Yeah.
Remove all U.S. troops.
100%.
And Michael, I want to get everybody's reaction to that. Is that too high a price to pay?
Well, I would never portray myself as an expert on South Korea's defense. Let me just say that I hope if Trump sits down with Kim Jong-un, that the president surrounds himself with people who have expertise and a variety of issues regarding North Korea. And I don't see that right now in the administration. Yeah. And that makes me very nervous.
Well, and there's another nuance to this as well.
Well, he should also let the Secretary of State know.
And that is, exactly.
Maybe invite him along to
at least text him.
Yeah, at least let him know.
Or tweet him.
You know? Either or. A DM.
But there's another nuance here, and that is a strong Korean peninsula, how does that change the dynamic in Asia with China
and Japan?
And now, alongside of this, we just got wind that the Chinese premier just eliminated term limits. Yeah. So now there's this.
Well, the president's not going to be fearful of that.
Right. But, the point is there are changes going on in China as well that suggest that China is trying to amass its own internal power. And what are the nuances with a competing Korean peninsula and China down the road? And I feel like that's something that is like maybe 10 chess moves ahead, but isn't necessarily out of the picture.
A big question will be, after you're talking about preparation of this, I have said on this program a number of times over the last couple of years when we brought this subject up, because of the association that he has with the Kim family, is there a role that Dennis Rodman would play?
Oh, Lord.
Would it be so? In fact, I even said, would it be so bizarre if Donald Trump sent Dennis Rodman? This goes back now a year and a half ago, and I think some of you around this table were part of that discussion.
Right.
Between now and the time this trip takes place, does any role emerge for Dennis Rodman? Does anybody believe that?
I say no for this reason, because if Dennis Rodman would have been useful, it would have been in the Otto Warmbier situation sooner.
Right.
So why not then?
In a humanitarian situation.
Yes, in a total humanitarian. Right. So
if I'm Jim Kelly, I'm going to take Dennis Rodman, put him in a crate, and drop him in the desert for the length of the negotiations.
Just for the sake
you
of
want him the furthest away from these negotiations. When I say headwinds,
but here's a guy who knows both of the participants.
And again, when I say Donald Trump's running in the headwinds, he's not exactly known for attention to detail or organization, you know. And he's going to sit down with North Koreans, a guy who's famous for these meetings with members of Congress, to say whatever, to make up policy on the spot, to cut off his own team or on the plank. That can't happen in these negotiations because words are going to have
the dramatic way that he pops his head into the press room and says,
exactly,
we're going to have an announcement in five
He's
minutes
excited.
On North Korea.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's change of subject.
Exciting stuff.
For him, yeah, because it means a change of subject. It means, like, I did something.
And also, well, that's the point.
But no forethought about what that means.
Isn't that the principal statement of Donald Trump's plans for his 2020 reelection? I did something. I didn't talk.
Yeah, but what?
I did.
But what?
Well, he's followed through on virtually all of his campaign promises.
Hasn't
made everyone. But I mean, if you look, Barack Obama
could say the same thing about the Iran deal, and Donald Trump bludgeoned him for it over the election. The worst deal ever made in history.
I don't believe Obama ran as a singular, having that as a singular item for his efforts.
I agree
for
with you that Trump wants a deal, especially if he's going to put skin in the game. If he wants to be involved, he'll want a deal, and he'll be desperate for one because it'll be his reputation that's involved. But the consequence of that deal could be history repeating itself, and that's a huge problem that people can't ignore.
I don't understand where we're going with this, because if we think, I think if the president's going to sit down with Kim Jong Un in May, and if we think that there's going to be a deal within 2 years,
no.
I think we're fooling ourselves.
Right.
I mean, if there are ongoing negotiations, that's great. And he may very well run for reelection based on ongoing negotiations.
He's been dialing
being
it back,
successful,
too.
Right.
You know, and we're talking, and that may be a strong position, but I don't think there's a deal to be made.
Well, they're not
within
using
that
the word negotiation anymore. They're calling it talks.
Right.
And they've actually said May is not the month when they'll meet. I think Trump himself said it. Time and date to be decided.
Well, and then there's debates about will there be preconditions and so forth, or what, you know. So,
well, I think the idea of preconditions. I think there may be others thrown out, but any condition that's thrown out now, whichever side throws it out, is going to look like a side that's trying to derail these talks. Mm-hmm. And right at the moment, I think the president probably, and he doesn't get a chance to do it very often, he's probably basking in the semi-credibility that some members of the media and even the Democrats have given to him, even reluctantly, because in this particular case, most of them, in fact, some of even, I think Joe Biden even said, that they're rooting for president. They don't want the president to fail on this because this is a big deal.
Let me add one more thing. I've heard some people say that this meeting is a bad idea because the president of the United States meeting with Kim Jong-un gives the North Korean regime legitimacy.
Right.
And you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you something. I don't really understand that concept.
Yeah.
Because when you're dealing with a country that has nuclear weapons and ICBMs, they've got legitimacy already. Yeah.
Exactly.
They're a legitimate power, whether we want to recognize it or not. So let's deal with the reality of the situation.
And they've been there since, 1946?
Yeah.
Kim Il-sung
took
over? Of course.
He is the leader, of a real country.
With powerful weapons.
Yeah, exactly.
But you see, that mindset, that attitude, in my view, that arrogance, that has permeated the foreign policy of the United States for decades.
Yes.
And I think that's one of the things that the people rejected when they voted for Donald Trump. They just said, we want to try something new.
Yep.
He suggested that he might do this during the campaign. Again, this is not something he hasn't suggested that he might do.
Right.
So, the point is, He's doing. It's one more thing he can tick off. I've said I'm going to do this, and between now, if this first meeting does take place in May, there's a lot of things that can happen, even if they're cosmetic, There's a lot of things that can happen between May and November.
Yes.
And as those things happen and unfold, yes, each of them gives Donald Trump more credibility in a very delicate field, yeah, which could help him.
I was going to say, he's already sort of won, even if nothing happens at this point. He's already won in a couple cases. One, he's, first of all, getting the media to at least acknowledge some achievement. And then secondly, to the extent that there are no more tests for a while, that's also another plus right now.
Yeah.
You are assuming everything is going to go Trump's way
in the run-up
to the negotiation and during. And there would be no errors like not having a Secretary of State say something completely different from what you're saying.
No, I understand that with Donald Trump, you don't quite know. It could be horrible.
And that's dangerous. That's very risky.
It's risky, but insofar as the voters are concerned, you have a president trying to do something. Now, if he stubs his toe and really screws up, then he's going to pay a price for that.
Right.
But that's the risk, because he's being measured at the moment. He's being measured at the moment for three generations of political leadership that basically wanted to talk and didn't want to do anything. We've got to pause. Back shortly from Chicago. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at briansellsthedesert.com. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks for joining us. We're going to switch gears now and talk about another big topic that dominated the news last week, and that is when the Attorney General of the United States, Jeff Sessions, went to Sacramento, California to give a speech and to announce that there was going to be a federal prosecution of the state of California for their sanctuary cities policies, and it resulted in a series of reactive comments, incendiary comments coming the other way from Jerry Brown, the governor of California, and also Mayor Libby Schaaf from Oakland, California. She is the mayor that has decided to let those in her constituents know in advance that ICE was coming in to try to arrest some people who are in this country illegally. And it's been a huge issue with sanctuary cities. And I wanted to get reaction, so we've reached out to Phil Cowan. Phil Cowan is the morning man on KTKZ. That is our affiliate in Sacramento, California. And Phil, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway this evening.
Good to be here, Bruce. Thanks for having me.
My first question to you, before we get to the specifics of that, everyone knows that there's not a lot of Republican votes that come out of California, at least in the Electoral College. So my question to you is, you're a morning host on a conservative station, the Salem station, in the capital of the great state of California. How do you and your conservative listeners, how do you get along every day when you're in this bastion of left-wing politics?
It's not easy, I'll tell you what. And a lot of the conversation on a daily basis revolves around a lot of us folks in my age range who are considering other places to move upon retirement. The people are fleeing the state. The other topic of discussion that has come up because of it is secession. There is the State of Jefferson movement, which seeks to split the state, split off a lot of the rural northern counties. And there's a second movement now, the New California movement, which really incorporates a split that I would prefer and have always thought would benefit the state, to split it east and west, leave the coastal counties to themselves and leave the rest of the state represented. Because as it currently stands, and it's no secret, it happens in Illinois and it happens in New York and it happens in a variety of states, all of California policy is driven by LA and Bay Area voters. And right. that's just the way it is because that's where the population centers are.
Now, let's throw into this discussion the mayor of Oakland, who's now become somewhat famous for her decision to inform those in her bailiwick that the ICE officers were coming to enforce laws in her community. What has been the reaction? What level of reaction is there in California to the actions of the Oakland mayor?
There are a great many people here, Bruce, who believe that she should be prosecuted for obstruction of justice, to be perfectly frank. And, you know, even as progressive, and that's a word I sort of eschew because I don't think there's anything progressive about what the left prescribes as policy goals these days. But even in a state this progressive, I think it's extremely telling that on this issue of sanctuary policies, polling broadly, nationally, and in this state, clearly indicate people oppose these policies. Even in the Latino community, it's been a pretty steady 55% have said we don't like it because they don't want those folks back in their neighborhood any more than anyone else would.
Now, in the current or the raids that recently took place, there were a couple of hundred people that were wrapped up or rounded up. The vast majority of them, I think almost 180 of them, did have criminal records other than being just in the country illegally. And yet the head of ICE, the acting head of ICE, basically said that he thought that by alerting the raid, that perhaps there were hundreds, maybe 500 or 600, who got away and are now back into the body politic, either in Oakland or elsewhere around the country. Is that – are those numbers – have they been verified by anybody since the raid took place last week?
No, and they keep going up, frankly. I think the first number we heard was 120, and then it went to 180, and now we're hearing 400, 500, 600. Suffice it to say, some folks probably skated because of it. And, you know, sadly, there are some immigrants who are being swept up in these raids, kind of a la the old-fashioned La Migra raids, where immigration would come banging on doors. Mm-hmm. And that's been a source of extreme consternation. But on the part of the state of California, if you don't want those people swept up in a raid where we're looking for genuine bad actors, then turn them over to ICE while you have them incarcerated.
Now,
it places ICE agents at risk having to try and go out and make these arrests on the street instead of in a controlled environment in a county jailhouse. Plus, it puts those immigrants who aren't otherwise criminal at risk of being swept up.
Stephanie Hitt is with us. She has a question for you. Go ahead, Stephanie.
Well, I think you actually addressed the very question I have, and that is regarding the safety of ICE agents. Because if ICE agents can't collect someone while they're already detained, while they are without weapons, then we are putting at great risk not just the ICE agents, but entire neighborhoods when there's a raid, when people are fleeing, where they might actually want to fight the ICE agents. I mean, I think what we're seeing, based on some of these California policies and these new laws, is a real safety issue, not just to ICE agents, but to the whole population. And how are people
Absolutely.
Reacting about that?
Well, and then obviously ICE has reacted quite strongly, and I think a lot of Californians see it as well. I haven't heard much from the folks who live in the neighborhoods that are being affected, but I think it only stands to reason, and common sense would tell you. As I said, if you have an opportunity to take possession of that inmate in a controlled environment. And Sacramento was a bit unique. Here in Sacramento County, Sacramento County Sheriff Scott Jones, and we've had this discussion before, we actually have ICE on site at the Sacramento County Jail, and they have a contract with ICE at the Southern, the Rio Cosumnes Correctional Facility. We have a separate correctional facility in the South County where they, under contract, house ICE detainees. So we're a little different, and how that contract is going to jibe with the new California laws remains to be seen.
Phil, one thing that for those that support sanctuary cities, part of their argument is that those that are in the country, even illegally, they're living lives as Americans would, and they've been doing it for many, many years. And the police departments have to rely on them to fight crime in the areas where they live. And that if government comes down too hard on those who are here illegally, even though, let's say, they've committed no other crime, that the police departments of any sanctuary city, they lose a valuable piece of intelligence that they may need to fight the bigger, broader war on crime. Have you had any communication with any police officers that either vehemently disagree with that premise or agree with it?
Well, I have spoken with our county sheriff about it, and I find that to be, you know, that's the argument that's been around for a while, and it's a straw man argument. There is no reason why any immigrant in the community should be fearful of someone who's committed a crime, who's been incarcerated in the county jail, they're in the lockup, being handed over to ICE. How does that affect them or place them at risk from law enforcement?
Are they worried about putting their name on a list or even filing a report against them? I think that's at least that's part of this. Maybe it's a myth, but it's used as the straw man argument.
I think it's absolutely a myth. Those people aren't getting arrested because, you know, look, if they got arrested, somebody filed a complaint or they got caught in the commission of a crime.
Mm-hmm.
You know, clearly we're still arresting plenty of illegal immigrants for other crimes. Handing them over to ICE when ICE asks for a detainer does not place anybody at risk. And I point again to the polling, which, you know, consistently shows that a majority, even in the Latino community, think sanctuary policies are a bad idea.
Chris Voronis is here. He has a question for you, Phil.
Phil, I have a more global question, which immigration politics may play into. But a couple weeks ago, the Democratic Party of California did not endorse Dianne Feinstein. What's going on there, and what, if any, what if any, is the long-term impact on Democratic politics in the state?
Well, as far as progressivism is concerned, California apparently appears to be at the vanguard, has been for a long time. I was born and raised here, and I've lived here all my life, except for a couple of years when early in my career when I was off doing a morning show in Detroit and in Dallas. And the flower child ethos has taken hold here and never gone away. And just the other day, our junior senator, Kamala Harris, said that she believes California is the future. And I certainly hope, for the sake of the country, it's not the future of the United States. But I do believe it's the future of the Democratic Party. They have taken a much harder left turn than I think any of us anticipated in the wake of the Trump election, and I'm not sure it's a winning strategy.
Michael Bauer's a Democrat. He's got a question for you as well, Phil.
You know, Phil, you live in a state where there are a number of industries who are highly dependent on the employment of undocumented persons. What do you think the appropriate resolution of the immigration issue should be?
I would love, quite frankly, to see us have a robust guest worker program. You know, there are plenty of immigrants who come here and work seasonally, especially in the ag industry, who would love nothing better in the off season than to go back home. But under the current system, they can't, because then they have to risk another illegal crossing to get back. We need to improve the guest worker program. And frankly, you know, the other industries that rely upon them, construction has become very dependent upon them. Those are jobs that other people used to do. They've just been undercut, frankly, in the wage market by cheap immigrant labor. And that needs to stop. We could have a whole discussion. I've spoken with my friend Ted Hayes in L.A. about this with the Project 21 Leadership Council. And he says quietly
Phil,
under the radar.
Phil, I've got to interrupt. We'll be back shortly on Beyond the Beltway with Phil Cowan. Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv.
That is
Dumont back in Chicago with our guests around the table, and also Phil Cowan joins us live via Skype from his home in Sacramento, California. He's the morning man on KTKZ, The Answer, AM 1380 in the capital state of California. Phil, a question to you, getting back to sort of what it's like to be a conservative surrounded by liberals in a very liberal state. For those, you know, those who live beyond California, they have a political image of what San Diego is like, what San Francisco is like, a little bit what Los Angeles is like. They may not have a clear vision of what sort of a city politically and even culturally Sacramento is. So paint us a little picture of Sacramento. It's the state capital, so it's a capital city. But what are the other unique things about that market? Because you know it like the back of your hand.
Well, unique, I'm not sure. It is a lovely town, always has been. And I'm always torn because the city leaders are always scrambling to try and make this a bigger and better and more world-class city. And I think a lot of us like it the way it is, and it always has been. Kind of a quiet town, very leafy, and it really is. It's a government town, let's face it. There are so many state employees here, and there are also federal offices as well. But, you know, in terms of other industry, I'll tell you what it is. It's a great food town. Boy, the restaurant scene here is fantastic.
What is the – back to the focal point of the discussion, and that is the relationship of the federal government to the state government. Again, the U.S. Attorney General, he is filing suit against the state of California. There's been the war of words between the governor and the mayor of Oakland back at Jeff Sessions. Governor Brown called it a publicity stunt. He said, you're out here showing your macho because the president is about to fire you. It got very, very personal. Where does this case go next in the courts?
Well, I think any casual observer, and I'm no attorney, views this as a loser for California. They're flying in the face of the Supremacy Clause. Three measures really are what amounted to this sanctuary state policy. One in the Senate, which forbids law enforcement from cooperating with federal authorities in a broad range of matters, can't communicate with them, and a host of other things.
This is the state. State Senate in California.
Yeah. Yes. And the state assembly passed a couple of measures, one of which establishes an inspection system and really seeks to regulate federal incarceration of immigrants here in the state, which, again, is a direct, you know, directly countermands federal law, and the Supremacy Clause will shoot that down. And the third actually would penalize, and it's another assembly measure, the third would penalize employers who cooperate with INS and actually requires them by law to notify their employees if they know that an inspection is coming up. And you know, I don't know who they think they're protecting here, but you know, Governor Brown referred to this as an act of war on the part of the federal government against California, and I think most of us just see it as a response
to California's
provocation.
Mike Miller is a professor of economics at DePaul University. He's got a reaction to that comment.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely correct. I could just imagine during the 1950s when all the problems were happening with regard to education in the South and the police had to be brought in to enforce federal law. How in the world can people in California come to the conclusion that they're their own country, that they can violate these? You interact with these people. What do you get? Being an academic, what I find of many of my colleagues are three things: smugness, condescension, and moral superiority. That's what they are in terms of me. They are all those things. And I just wonder.
It sounds like a day at the California Capitol.
Yeah, exactly. I'm just. Do these people really not think it through that they're all of a sudden deciding which laws that they can enforce and which ones they won't? And why didn't they think of these things before the Democrats helped pass all these immigration laws in the first place?
That is a very good question, because I have to believe once this gets into the courts, and they may shop around and find some federal judges who will, because there will always be some. Oh, yeah. who will rule in their favor. If it ultimately winds up before the Supreme Court, they will lose. And California is playing a dangerous game here because they're very reliant on federal money. They had to go to the feds for hundreds of millions of dollars to fix the Oroville Dam, which they mismanaged into disaster and had to evacuate downriver in the Feather River watershed, almost 200,000 people last year. And our high-speed rail project, which was sold to California voters as originally a $33 billion project, San Francisco to L.A., we just found out Friday, the price tag has gone up to 77 and may go as high as 98, which means it will be about twice that. They are planning on completing that project with a combination of private investment and federal money. So I don't know why they think the feds will continue to pump money into this state, given their continuing provocation.
Given the high visibility of this situation now involving the federal government, the attorney general, and the mayor of Oakland, doesn't she have to be made an example of what happens if you have a mayor that just is egregious in her denunciation of federal law?
One would certainly think that is going to be the position of the Trump administration.
On that note, we have to say farewell to Phil Cowan, Morning Man.
I appreciate it.
Thank you very much.
Nice
to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway. When we come back in our next hour, we're going to be joined by Howard Kurtz, media critic of Fox News, back shortly from Chicago.
This March, Goodman Theatre Artistic Director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheatre.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Live from Chicago, this is Bruce Dumont with our Beyond the Beltway analysis of national politics. featuring occasional injections of rumor and innuendo, all offered up by a panel of political insiders, pundits, power brokers, public servants, professors, and most importantly, plain-speaking Americans from coast to coast. Tonight, featuring commentary by Michael Bauer, Stephanie Hitt, Mike Miller, Chris Veronis, and special guest Howard Kurtz. Our program tonight coming to Mar-a-Lago Base at the Museum of Broadcast Communications in Chicago. Toll-free lines open at 1-800-723-8289. That's 1-800-723-8289. If you'd like to email me a comment, it's brucedumont@museum.tv. You want to tweet me a comment, it's @Dumo. And, of course, you can join us on the World Wide Web, audio and video, wherever you are around the world, beyondthebeltway.com. We begin at the top of our broadcast this evening with a special guest joining us from Washington, D.C. He is Howard Kurtz. He is the host of Media Buzz on Fox News Channel. And Howard, nice to have you with us on Beyond the Beltway.
Very nice to be here.
I would like to begin with one of the stories that everybody talked about on the Sunday morning shows this morning. And that was the president's speech last night in western Pennsylvania. He singled out several members of the media, including Chuck Todd, who he referred to as a sleepy SOB. And my reaction to you, you alluded to it on your program today, but is that the use of those terms by the president? Is that just for that base, or do you think there's an audience around the country that is cheering when he takes out a nationally known media commentator?
Well, the president's fans love it when he beats up on the mainstream media. They don't trust the media, and they don't like the way their guy, their street fighting champion, is treated. But I think when he goes after individual journalists by name, by the way, he's got every right to hit back against what he sees as unfair coverage. But I think he kind of punches down when he goes after Sunday show hosts or cable news hosts, uses that kind of language, which you just cleaned up. Mm-hmm. One of the things I report in my book, Media Madness, as we'll talk about, is despite the fact that he always seems to be picking on Chuck Todd, and he really has it in for NBC, in part because he used to do The Apprentice there, he's had a number of secret off-the-record meetings at the White House with the moderator of Meet the Press, and they usually start this way. President yells at Chuck, Chuck yells back, and then they settle down to a civil conversation.
But he doesn't do Meet the Press.
Well, he doesn't do any Sunday shows. In fact, outside of Fox News, the president has done very little. Now, he is surprisingly accessible to the press, not for big formal news conferences as we are accustomed to, but he's taking questions almost every day at these photo ops and when he's going to the helicopter and when he's going to the plane. And so that's a change, and I applaud that. At the same time, you know, this is a president who hits back hard, as you all know, as your listeners all know, at what he calls fake news. I think he overuses that term to the point that it gets kind of drained of meaning. But, you know, in my observation during the campaign, and I've known Donald Trump and interviewed him since the late 1980s, and as president, is that none of us has ever seen anything like this pretty relentless negative coverage of this president. Some of it self-inflicted, some of it controversies that he creates, but a lot of it just journalists who are not giving the guy the benefit of the doubt.
When this continued after the election, Howie, I said in this program once, because there was this debate between Donald Trump winning the Electoral College and Hillary Clinton winning the popular vote, that if you're running a network, you have to look at the total number of people out there, and you've got to decide which audience you're going to go after. And Fox had really carved out that they were going to continue to go after the Electoral College vote that Donald Trump won, and the other competitors having to go left. They're thinking that they're speaking to the vast popular vote constituency of America, which basically will spend more money, buy more. They're demographically more correct, and that's part of what's going on here. Is they don't want to say anything nice about Donald Trump because it doesn't fit their business model. Is there any truth to that?
There's a lot of truth to that. I mean, MSNBC obviously has always been a liberal network. But CNN, where I used to work, used to kind of position itself as the down-the-middle network. The Reporters Network didn't have a lot of openly ideological hosts. That has changed radically since Donald Trump was elected. Donald Trump, who used to work with Jeff Zucker at NBC, Zucker being the president, of course, of CNN. And, you know, the panels every night, 6-1, 7-1 against Trump, the stories even during the day having a negative Trump spin. And yet, while CNN's ratings are nothing near Fox's, CNN's ratings are much better than a few years ago. But that's the business model. My argument is, and the same true of the New York Times and others, is that they are going to pay a price, and are in fact paying a price in terms of credibility, because while you can make money catering to a certain audience, in this case anti-Trump, the price for your journalistic credibility, even among independents and moderates who might not love Trump but are willing to give him a chance or would like to see him succeed so the country succeeds, I think those operations with the one-sided nature and some of the high-profile mistakes are losing some of the public trust that they once had.
But also, in addition to the news division, it's gone over to the entertainment division with Jimmy Kimmel and with Stephen Colbert. I mean, Stephen Colbert, he got off the mat in a rating-wise when he woke up and decided the best way to get back was to attack Trump, and he's been a big winner in the ratings ever since. And he pushes the envelope every night, and Jimmy Kimmel has picked up that chalice as well.
Yeah, you know, the whole section of Media Madness is about the late-night comics, and if you look at it, I mean, I see Fallon as the one guy who's a little more apolitical, even though he's had to sort of been pushed in that direction as well. But you look at all of them. I mean, Jimmy Kimmel, of course, has been crusading to keep Obamacare, right, for gun control and all that. Samantha Bee, John Oliver, Seth Meyers, I mean, they all come out and kick the hell out of the president. And all presidents get mocked, of course, but in a very personal and visceral way. And Colbert, you know, who played the sort of Bill O'Reilly character on Comedy Central, he's been the leader. And you're exactly right. He was mired in last place. His show got more political, more blatantly anti-Trump. In a couple of cases, very crude jokes about the president. And suddenly he's number one. So in his case, it's paying off.
The title of your book is Media Madness. We're talking to Howard Kurtz from Fox News and Media Buzz. And I just want to say that, I've said this on the air before when you were not present. I'll say it here while you are present. Of all the commentators, of anyone that's on cable news, I have always viewed you as the most objective. And given the fact you have a tremendous credential, not only with Fox, CNN before that, and also years with the Washington Post, you call it as straight as anybody on the air. So I want to congratulate you. I've said it when you were not here. I'll say it when you're right here.
I do appreciate that. And it's an old-fashioned approach to journalism that what means is you get beat up from both sides, but that's okay. But I appreciate the observation.
But I want to ask this point. Mm-hmm. When you are there, when you're in a newsroom, let's turn back the clock, you know, 10, 20 years ago when you were working for other entities than you're right. working for right now. When you came out with a position that you thought was fair and objective, did those left of center people that you worked with in the newsroom, did they think you were a right winger by trying to be objective? How did they justify your objective analysis of a story that they might have a different opinion with? That's the question. I've got to pause for a commercial break. We're talking with Howard Kurtz. When I come back, I'll be anxious to hear your answer to that question. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thank you for joining us tonight on Beyond the Beltway.
This March, Goodman Theater artistic director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theater, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheater.org.
Bruce Dumont back on Beyond the Beltway. We're talking with Howard Kurtz, author of the book Media Madness, Donald Trump, the Press, and the War Over the Truth. Before the break, I asked you a question, Howard, about working a story in a newsroom. You're trying to be fair and objective, and you're surrounded maybe by left-of-center journalists that you work with, and they can't imagine when you come up with something that is fair. They think that you're a right-winger by having a different view. Does that happen a lot, or did that happen a lot?
I don't think people thought I was a closet right-winger or a left-winger. There were certainly some people at these organizations who thought I wasn't tough enough on conservatives because, in their view, conservatives were, you know, bad people. I remember writing a couple of stories about things that had been reported by Fox or organizations like that that hadn't gotten picked up in the mainstream media and then turned out to be big scandals, would sort of scold the press for being slow to the party. And that sort of thing would sometimes, but you know, one of the things about being a media critic is you don't make anybody happy. You were like the internal affairs cop, and I got used to that a long time ago.
When you look at the 2016 campaign, the major networks virtually all missed the story. They missed the story that Trump was coming along and that Trump was going to win. Yet, in my view, I have not read of any major news executive or even on-air talent that got fired for being so wrong in such a big way. Have I missed somebody being dumped because of their inaction and their lack of correctness in 2016?
No, and it went well beyond the networks, the newspapers, and the websites. And you know, one of the reasons that I didn't underestimate Donald Trump was because I had gotten to know him in New York when he was sort of the media master in that tabloid market. And so I knew that he had certain talents, you know, strengths as well as weaknesses, that most of my colleagues did not anticipate. And even at Fox, I was on endless on-air panels with these brilliant political prognosticators who said, you know, Trump is an entertaining sideshow, but he won't make it to Iowa. And, of course, he's not going to win the nomination. And then in the general, you know, find me 10 people who said that he was going to beat Hillary Clinton. I remember going on my show that Sunday morning and saying, look, it's not impossible that Trump could still win this thing, and it's a mistake for the media to write him off.
Yep. Well, we said it on this program about 9 months in advance of the campaign. We understood that based on callers and doing the show from different affiliates. But the one guy that sticks out with me that I'm amazed that he still has a job, and that's Matthew Dowd. I think Matthew Dowd has been wrong more often than any analyst I can think of, and yet he's there virtually every Sunday on ABC. But anyway.
The bigger point here is not that the press blew the election. We blow a lot of elections. It was the failure to see that Donald Trump as a candidate was connecting with what we might call working class voters and the larger economic frustrations that powered his candidacy. And Bill, he has a lot of support in those states and in those regions as president.
Right. Stephanie Hitt has a question for you.
Yes, Howard, thank you so much for joining us tonight. It's such an honor to be able to speak to you. So I have something, and this was brought up a little bit on your show, and this is something that during the years I've been doing this, I always try to bring up this point. It's a little bit on the lighthearted side, and that is I feel like much of the media does not get Donald Trump's sense of humor, his own sense of irony. A perfect example is the joke that he joke that he made about having the Russians find her emails and how, you know, there was some real outrage that might be treasonous. And I feel like it goes back to this saying that many of Trump's supporters take him seriously, but not literally, and many of his detractors take him literally, but not seriously. And maybe you could speak to that in terms of the media bias and what I see as a genuine sense of humor.
Yeah, you know, it's actually not that light a point. It's actually a pretty serious point because journalists, you know, I guess we probably humor impaired, but we take everything literally. We weigh every word. And when someone like Donald Trump, you know, he's like the guy at the bar and he exaggerates. And when he looked into that camera, I was watching this live, Russia, if you're listening, how about finding the deleted emails? Well, if he really wanted Russia to do that, presumably he would have done it through a back channel and not at a news conference. More recent example would be when the president, and he made a point of this at the rally last night, May, and I had talked about it on the air. When he was with a room full of donors and he's kidding around, he says, well, you know, President Xi is now president for life in China. Maybe we ought to try that here. And everybody was laughing. Can't tell you how many articles I've seen saying Trump attracted to dictatorial powers. Come on.
Yeah. Chris Veronis has got a comment.
Howard, there are many who like look at the news and throw up their hands and just wonder why we can't have fair and objective news. And and so we addressed it a moment ago. You did, Bruce. I mean, it's the business model, right? There's ratings there to be pugilistic, go after Trump. There's money there. And so my question is, could there be conceivably a crescendo effect where this just turns into noise? And, you know, when the sugar high wears off, people feel horrible and they don't want anything to do with the media that beats up on Trump or just is perceived to be not fair and objective. And then along with that, could we ever get to the point where you look at a journalist, maybe like in the vein of Peter Jennings, and you actually don't know what their political leaning is? Would that ever
be? I would know what his political leaning was. But
I think we do.
Go ahead, Howard.
You get
the
question.
Well, you know, the media, like politics, like society, has gotten so polarized these days that there are very few people who, you know, I mean, there are some good reporters, even here in Washington. I don't say tar everybody with this brush, but basically, mm-hmm. We have a system now that rewards being snarky, having a take, polarization, mm-hmm. leaning left, anti-Trump, whatever. And I do think that we've reached a point where, as I was saying earlier, so many journalists have lost credibility. In my book, I lay out what journalists say privately about President Trump, either to their friends or they think only their pals are listening on Twitter. There's a sort of a visceral disdain for the guy that goes beyond ideology. There are also a lot of prominent conservatives in the media who were never Trump in their campaign, still don't like the president. And so I think there's sort of almost a cultural war. This taps into your Stephen Colbert point, Bruce, against this president. It's not just on the basis of politics.
Would you also say when it comes to media arrogance that also is – that has a conservative wing and a liberal wing? That conservatives can also be arrogant and dismissive of what's happening beyond the Beltway.
I would absolutely say that. And you see the opposing camps when they fight it out on social media, which I think I generally love social media, but it can be kind of a toxic sewer at times. When you have not only people saying, no, you're wrong about that issue, but, you know, attacking you in the most personal, harsh, vitriolic terms. Women get this in particular, a lot of sexual comments. And I think that's really contributing to the sort of taking down the tone of society.
Michael Bauer, got a comment.
Howard, what do you think are both the short-term and long-term effects of the president constantly referring to the media as fake media and enemies of the people?
Well, I have said, and I will say to you tonight, I think when President Trump says the media, the enemy of American people, he goes way too far. He crosses a line, which is not to say we are sometimes our own worst enemy. As for fake news, you know, I've written about real fake news. I'm the guy who exposed Jason Blair, the serial fabricator at the New York Times, and some other fabricators and plagiarists. That's fake news. The president uses that so often, I think he drains it of meaning, because sometimes he uses it to mean news that he just doesn't like. Now, there have been a lot of high-profile mistakes written about this president, three of them last year at CNN. One of those cases involved three journalists being fired. Brian Ross at ABC was suspended. I don't think they deliberately set out to fabricate, but I think the bar is so low against Donald Trump that some investigative stories that are just half-baked or quarter-baked get rushed onto the air, rushed into print, and the media organizations have paid a price.
Mike Miller of DePaul University with a final question.
Howard, looking to the future, I don't see much changing, partly because being in the university setting, we've replaced truth as our goal with social justice. And I just wonder, do you see a generational difference that all the people coming out of the J schools and communication departments and so forth, that they don't really care about the truth? They only care about trying to change the world.
I hope that's not true. I see some good young reporters who actually do care about the truth. At the same time, you're right that a lot of people have just sort of see it as their mission to crusade, whether it's on the right or the left. I'm very troubled by the liberal shouting down of conservative guests who go to speak at the various college campuses. And people always ask me, well, is this going to change between the president and the press? And I say, not anytime soon, because the press is a big fat target, a great foil for a president who came up fighting the coverage, which was often unfair. And the president not only has gotten under the skin of journalists, but they have reacted to, you know, calling the New York Times an evil and failing newspaper and that sort of thing. And it seems to be almost in their interest to play to their base and attack the president. None of this, both sides are hurt, but I believe the press is hurt more, and that when Donald Trump is no longer in the White House, it will be very hard for a lot of these outfits to get that credibility back.
One last question. Mm-hmm. Why is Stormy Daniels an important subject now, in your opinion?
I interviewed the president's personal lawyer, Michael Cohen, about that. And it's a story that most people don't care about. Who cares what Donald Trump did a decade ago when he's a private businessman? But you now have allegations of hush money, $130,000 payment. You have legal threats. You have Michael Cohen telling me that he did this to protect Donald Trump personally, not to influence the campaign. That's his story. If any other president was accused of acquiescing in, paying off somebody who was a former alleged paramour, it would be a story. I can't say it's a non-story. It may not lead to anything, but I don't think it completely be ignored.
Howard Kurtz has been our guest. He is author of the book Media Madness, Donald Trump, the Press, and the War Over the Truth. He is with the Fox News, Fox News Channel. It's Media Buzz. It's every Sunday morning. And again, as I've said on many occasions, I think one of the best of the best. This is the first time we've met. Howard, thank you very much for being with us tonight on Beyond the Beltway. And keep up doing the terrific job that you're doing, keeping an eye on the media, okay?
Thank you.
I'm Bruce Dumont, back shortly with our panel from Chicago. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at BrianSellsTheDesert.com. Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us this evening. We're going to spend just a few moments following up on the Stormy Daniels issue. Not so much on the charge, although you can all comment on it. But Howard made the point, it is a legal issue now as to what money was used, what was the purpose of the money, and it's moving beyond the just the salacious story. But does anybody, let me pose this question. Does anybody believe her story? Who believes her story?
What do you mean her story?
What's her story?
Her story is that there was an affair between herself and Donald Trump.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yes.
Absolutely.
Yes.
Okay. There are people
okay.
who think it might be true, but,
okay.
but
Stephanie,
they don't
yes,
care.
Yes, it happened.
Okay. Yeah,
okay.
He denies it.
I'm asking one question at a time. And the next question is, when a friend writes a check for $130,000 to a person who allegedly has had an affair with a friend of his...
He's an employee of Donald Trump.
How many friends would do that for another friend?
Well, keep in mind, it's not just the friend. It's the timing of this.
Yeah.
The timing of this was less than a month before the election. So the question becomes, and I'm not an expert in this, but the question becomes, under federal election law, was this some sort of in-kind contribution to the Trump campaign, similar to the thing that tripped up John Edwards, and that John Edwards... criminally charged with.
But he used campaign funds, didn't he? Didn't John Edwards use
campaign? No, he had a donor. Yeah. He had a major donor who paid off his paramour.
Look, I happen to believe that both things are true. Both things. The White House's defense of this is pathetic. It's pathetic.
What do you want them to be saying?
But I'm just saying... When you get the spokespeople saying, I don't know if that's true, instead of outright denial. When they talk about arbitration, sort of validates that there was...
They came out with denials. They've used denials.
Now they're not. They're backing it down. The point I'm trying to get at, is there's a pathetic defense going on, but also this is a nothing burger like we've seen before, although way more juicy. And this lawsuit is not seeking any kind of damage. The only thing that it wants to do is humiliate Donald Trump. And I say that as a Trump critic. This is going nowhere. And the media, CNN puts it on as their headline story. Right. for like two or three nights in a week. It's ridiculous.
And you know why it steals
attention away from North Korea.
Yes.
Right. Issues from any like success. That.
It's ridiculous. Yeah,
but, you know, here's the other thing. Let's just dial it back a bit. We're talking about $130,000. I know that's a lot of money for a lot of people. But speaking as a lawyer who's dealt with a lot of settlements in lawsuits, that's actually kind of a nuisance value amount. When you think about someone who might have some very salacious details that could really strike harm into the president, when you look at the kind of money that people seek in those, that's actually not a lot of money. So it makes you wonder how serious her claim really was and what she was really trying to get at when she wanted, when she you was know, threatening.
Or she was a horrible negotiator.
I want to ask this question because, again, it was asked frequently during the Monica Lewinsky, Bill Clinton tete-a-tete at the White House. The media and the public asked frequently, gee, how does Hillary deal with this? How does she deal with this? There was a great sympathy for Hillary Clinton during that period. What about Melania? What about the relationship of the president to Melania now? Mm-hmm. With this story out there. I mean, the son is young enough to understand what's going on here.
That's right.
I mean, what is the personal damage to Donald Trump? And he's not a sympathetic figure.
Right.
And because of this, he shouldn't necessarily be, not necessarily, he shouldn't be a sympathetic figure.
Yeah, but, you know.
But again, he is a human being.
Right.
And this has to have some impact on Melania.
I agree, but the only question, I don't even know how long they've been married. How long? Anybody know? I mean, this happened in 2006.
Yeah.
I think they've been married about 15 years.
Okay.
When they had the affair.
But you were all so quick to say, I'm sure it happened. I just wonder, I think of the Rolling Stone article at the University of Virginia and Jackie,
Mike,
that was a lie. And then we have the Duke lacrosse case. Oh, and that was a lie.
Or maybe the 10 women are going to bring lawsuits.
Anyone around this table knows we weren't in the room when they were doing whatever they were doing or not.
I will reel back what I said, and it is an allegation. But it's also very true that Donald Trump brags about all the affairs that he's had.
Yeah, but some...
quite honestly, even if you ask the most diehard, red cap-wearing Trump supporter... If you ask them if it's true, would you put it past them? No one would deny.
It's unbelievable. It's unbelievable.
Highly believable. Highly believable.
He did have a Playboy image. But going back to your question, Bruce, about Melania, here's the thing. And this is a frustrating thing as a woman watching other women do this. Melania doesn't get a lot of sympathy in the press. She is not a beloved first lady. And so I think that there was a lot more sympathy for Hillary.
I think she's seen, she's got a stoic quality.
She does have a stoic quality. And as a result, you do not see a lot of outpouring of concern for Melania's feelings or the protection of Donald Trump's family.
But then again, married to a billionaire. So, I mean, how much sympathy are you really going to have?
It shouldn't matter.
Like
she's
model,
still a
international
person with feelings.
I agree. I agree with you, Stephanie.
And with the Me Too movement and all of these things about recognizing women, nobody stands up for Melania. Trump, because she's not the right.
Well, I think there's also partly a perspective, rightly or wrongly, that. And by the way, similar to Hillary, she knew what she was getting when she married Donald Trump.
Yep.
History was very clear and was very open. So, you know, she made her bed. Now she's lying in it.
Yeah.
You know, that's very cruel. I recognize.
Yeah. And never question somebody else's marriage. You never know.
Right.
I mean, relationships are unique
every
marriage.
I so agree with you. Yeah. You know what? I mean, people make judgments about whether Hillary should stay with Bill, whether Melania should stay with Donald, or whether she's just being paid or whatever. You know what? I think that's outrageous for someone to evaluate someone else's relationship and the internal workings.
So then why is this a news story? Is it just because there might be that campaign donation issue?
Didn't we conclude that earlier yeah. segment? The business model.
By the way,
she's a pretty woman.
It's a reason,
lots of pictures on CNN.
It's a reason for all the news operations, including Fox, to run the video and that tilt from her feet to her bosom,
all the way up.
Her ample bosom.
Right.
They run it bosom. Over and over.
Sure. Highlight not, that.
It is the last time you heard
just
that phrase.
Like the ample outrage bosom. On the tweet about
cleaning it up.
Well, yes. Bruce, you're right, because what about this Lord. Outrage regarding the tweet of Jennifer Lawrence with her Red Sparrow cast, where they were all wearing jackets and she was in a dress, and that set off a huge. Huge ripple through the tweet sphere.
You know, the
they
one
liked
thing.
Pictures of pretty women.
They
you know,
like
Michael Cohn. Yes. I don't know whether you've seen this
and
before.
She's an attractive woman right. with an ample bosom.
You know, Michael Cohn, I recognize he's the Trump Organization lawyer and stuff, but I remember him during the campaign, and I thought he made some awfully stupid comments during the campaign. And he's making some awfully stupid comments right now and trying to justify him taking out a home equity loan to come up with $130,000.
Which
is not believable. His story is
highly,
not believable.
Highly unethical as a legal counsel to do that on behalf of your client without telling him.
That's, you know, yes. You are not supposed to make those kinds of payments.
And he didn't sign his real name, even in the non-disclosure.
Now that
they're not dealing with real names on either side.
They wanted to use false names. Right. That is fraudulent. And this came to light because the bank raised the hand about regarding
that's right.
the payment itself.
Spitzer.
We have to remember that it alerted – the federal banking authorities.
In a cosmic kind of context, and I'll, with the caveat, Michael, if it's true, the allegation, this is just sort of Donald Trump's past sort of catching up with him. Mm-hmm. Sloppy, irresponsible, I'll have someone else deal with it. And you've made this point, too, about Bill Clinton. I mean, everyone said, well, this is just sex. That's all it is. Yeah, but also Bill Clinton opened himself up to blackmail. And I think that applies here, too. And that's the one issue that gives me great concern about the whole thing.
You know, but also, when you talk about blackmail, that gets back to the most salacious aspects of the dossier, the Steele dossier.
Yes.
I mean, this is the hotel, the Russian, the prostitute, all of that.
Right.
I mean, that gets back with –
Yeah.
That's all blackmailable stuff, and yet it hasn't been proven.
Right.
It was used in the dossier. It hasn't been proven. I have always argued that I don't believe it because if it was true, I think the video would be out. It would
be
viral.
There'd be photos.
Between the two, the Trump dossier and the Stormy Daniels thing, there's a pathway to proving this. Where you don't have that with the dossier.
Yes. You know, Stormy Daniels has actually given an interview where she says she has physical evidence with Donald Trump's DNA on it.
Right. The new blue dress.
And I believe it.
The blue dress. Now, let me just add one last comment. I really am not a prude in any way. I don't really care what people in public life do and, you know, outside of their marriages. That's their entire business. I just want a certain level of discretion where I don't have to read about it afterward or hear about it afterward. I didn't like it with Bill Clinton being so indiscreet, and I don't like it with Donald Trump being so indiscreet.
Yeah, fair point.
Or Stormy Daniels being discreet. especially when she was on with Jimmy Kimmel a couple of weeks ago.
With the ample
being
bosom.
Very coy that it, there, it didn't really happen.
There's one little difference, and I'll point it out. Stormy Daniels happened a long time ago.
Yeah.
Nobody's alleging that Trump is having an affair while in office. Bill Clinton was doing this in office, and that is what makes people upset.
In the Oval Office.
Because while you're supposed to be...
We got to pause. Back shortly from Chicago.
Okay. Yeah.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Bruce Dumont back in Chicago. Thanks very much for joining us. Mike Miller, you are an economist at DePaul University.
Yes.
You have said on this program over the last couple of years, you were not a fan of Donald Trump. Mm-hmm. You voted for a third-party candidate. And yet the area that you most disagreed with Donald Trump about was trade.
Yes.
So you got this week everything you feared in Donald Trump.
Exactly right. And every time it's been tried...
being I'm originally from Pittsburgh. I'm originally from a steel town when there actually was steel in Pittsburgh. And I grew up in an area where protection of steel was prayed for. Literally, in churches would pray that we would protect steel so we could keep our jobs. And I understand the emotions behind it, mm-hmm. that we're protecting jobs of people. And he was near my home in my hometown of Pittsburgh, Moon Township. I get it completely. But there has never been a case where there has not been a drop in employment caused by tariffs. Now, you do protect the jobs of the people in those industries, there's no doubt. But from one perspective, that's inefficient. You're protecting the inefficient. Okay. That's not good. The second thing is we end up then paying more dollars for, say, a washer, a dryer, a car, or whatever. Yeah. When those dollars begin to build up in our budget, we then spend less on, say, a movie or a dinner out or whatever. Employment in those areas where we have to cut back because of the higher price is where the employment falls. Now, the big difference is you can literally go to Pennsylvania, and I use the expression, touch the nose of the people whose jobs have been protected.
Right.
I can touch them. I can see them. But you can't see the fact that a server's job in an Applebee's was lost because people simply don't have the money to go out and eat the way they used to.
When you measure the short-term and long-term impact of the trade policies mm-hmm. now as offered by the president, and you measure that juxtaposed to the Republican tax cut,
mm-hmm.
how easy is it going to be in November of this year or in November of 2020 to be able to say Donald Trump did things that made our economy better? Are you going to be able to figure out whether he made things better or worse?
Yes, because you'll be able to easily look at the effects of the tariff once we know all the details. We can actually look at the number of jobs which are protected. When it comes to the budget change, we already know. We already have the numbers in place. We'll know within 2 years what has happened, for example, to the budget deficit relative to what it would have been. Those numbers will be relatively known.
Yeah. When I was watching the announcement from the White House the other day with all the labor folks, the steel workers surrounding him in the White House when he signed the tariff, what popped through my head was the timing of it,
because mm-hmm.
it sort of came from nowhere. And my first reaction was, it's happening now because he wants to help this special election that's going on in Pennsylvania. That was my first thought.
Yep.
Then I looked at the group that surrounded him, saying, okay, you know what? This is about Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin.
Yeah.
It's about blue-collar guys. Yeah. This is part of his re-election effort. Here's my question, and I'll go in to get everybody's reaction. Between now and November, I don't think we're going to know the impact of the tariffs yet.
Right, that's correct.
So come November, those thick-necked guys surrounding the president, they're the guys that will make the difference in the election this November in those four states. And those four states are the key to his reelection. And he's praying that either the tax cuts are going to make everything look great in November of 2020, and he's going to hope, he's rolling the dice, that the trade things are everything opposite of what the professor just said.
Well, I mean,
Chris Voronis, do you agree with that?
Yes, I do. This was a political move by Trump.
Yes.
This is the first Republican to break the Democratic wall in three key states. He's got to consolidate that. And so everything that you said, Mike, is true on policy. And I just don't think Trump cares about policy, particularly trade, especially when you can't trace the consequences back
to
the original policy.
That's what makes it so hard.
You can't say the steel-consuming industries lost jobs and then peg it back versus like the tax cut where you could actually demonstrably say, well, the deficit increased.
Michael, do you see it as a political masterstroke for the reasons I just stated?
Well, there's another reason I think it's a political masterstroke, because the four states you mentioned, Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, all have Democratic senators running for re-election. Mm-hmm. And each of them will probably have a tough re-election. Trump's move on tariffs makes it a tougher reelection for each of those senators and helps Trump try to keep control of the Senate in Republican hands.
It puts Democrats on their heels, too. They really don't have a message when it comes to the tariffs. Right.
Does this also, because of the demographics that I've just described, a blue-collar demographic, does it also give the president an ability to go further left or center on gun issues? Because even though many of these same people may be NRA types, he's going to be able to maybe have a more suburban soccer mom position on guns. Is that a tricky way that he will try to reach out to people like you?
I don't know that he was openly, that he would consciously be making that. Now that you've made that connection, that is interesting.
I'm sure he's thinking about it.
Exactly. Here's the other thing is, I also think he's left open a back door if it doesn't work. He has pedaled back and said, you know, maybe some of our friendly countries won't be here. You know, so he is giving himself a lot of wiggle room on this one.
Okay. Well, the trade policy, watch it, because it's he knows where his bread is buttered. And I think this is all about that. And we'll see how it turns out. The economy may go to hell, but in those four states, it may look pretty good on Election Day. All right, thanks to all of our guests. Thank you all very much in studio. Thanks also to Howard Kurtz for joining us and also Phil Cowan from Sacramento, California, earlier in the broadcast. I'm Bruce Dumont. Thanks to Sam Greenberg and Dan Dorfman and Fritz Goldman for their assistance in the production of this program. Until next week, this is Bruce Dumont. Good night from Chicago.
This March, Goodman Theatre artistic director Robert Falls presents a thrilling new production of Ibsen's timely classic, An Enemy of the People. When a water contamination crisis puts their town in peril, two brothers face off in a battle of political ambitions and moral integrity. The fate of the community hangs in the balance. The Village Voice raves, An Enemy of the People is exhilarating to experience. An Enemy of the People at Goodman Theatre, March 10th through April 15th. Tickets at goodmantheatre.org.
Live from Chicago, it's Saturday Night Live, The Experience. Tuesday through Sundays and open late on Wednesday nights at the Museum of Broadcast Communications. Order tickets at museum.tv. Are you planning for the day when you can retire to your dream home in Palm Springs, California? A day surrounded by spectacular scenery, golf courses, a rich cultural life, and great dining? If you are, you'll need a guide, someone who knows where to look, an experienced broker, someone who knows the desert communities of Southern California and all they have to offer. That person is Brian Beard, who's been making dreams come true for over 13 years, selling over $100 million in real estate, including celebrity and architecturally significant homes to the rich and famous, and more importantly, to people just like you. Brian's company, Coldwell Banker, has agents worldwide, but Brian Beard is your man in Palm Springs. Call Brian now at 760-799-7096. That's 760-799-7096. Or visit him online at briansellsthedesert.com.